Welcome to this Wackle Gather podcast. My name is Claire Sadler, Marketing Director at DirectLine, proud member of Wackle and Chair of Wackle Gather. Wackle stands for Women in Advertising and Communications London and is a networking organisation that brings together the UK's most senior female leaders in marketing, advertising, media and communications. Our purpose is to accelerate gender equality in our industry, and to deliver this we focus on three things: inspiration, support and campaigning. One of the ways we provide inspiration and practical support to aspiring and ambitious women is through Gather, our annual training conference. And in this podcast series, we will be talking to some top female leaders, and it's being shared in advance of this year's Gather and is sponsored by Facebook. Our theme this year is Going Further Together. As success is rarely achieved alone, we're taking a look at the ingredients of a high-performing team and what it takes as a leader to build a high-performing team. My guest today is Penny James, Chief Executive Officer of the DirectLine Group. Penny graduated with a degree in statistics from Bath University and went on to qualify as a chartered accountant at what is now PwC. Penny has extensive board-level financial services experience, having previously worked in large blue chip companies like the Prudential and Zurich. She's also one of just five female CEOs in the FTSE 250, but is passionate about changing that statistic. Hello, Penny, and welcome. And thank you so much for taking time out to talk to us this afternoon.
Hi, Claire.
Hi. If I may, I'd like to open up maybe with a few general questions before we get on to our theme for Gather. You've had a stellar career in finance. Looking back, can you tell us who was your most influential boss on the way up and why was that?
Oh, serious question. Yeah, I don't think I look back and look at any one person that has kind of driven or shaped my career. In fact, generically, I try and look at people around me and always have done and pick out the attributes that you kind of want to mimic and then make them strongest and log those. But as I look all the way back to being in my early 20s, I had a finance director then who was my boss's boss, actually, who I think saw me for being a talent. Never told me as much, but over the course of about 8 years, dropped little opportunities in front of me. And it was only about 8 to 10 years down the line that I looked back and I realised that some of the things that I thought I'd gone out and grabbed actually had appeared because someone was just making them available to me. And I look back now, and when I look around at the teams that I work with, I think you have a real responsibility when you're in a senior role, whatever that may be, to be looking out for the people who are the talents of the future and making sure that they get the opportunities they need to build the breadth into their career. And I was just very lucky that he saw that in me.
Yeah, and I would agree. I think certainly through my career, there's been those people that have just passed interesting projects or opportunities your way at the right time. I suppose also looking back at your career, what would you say might have been the best career decisions you've made, or ones that perhaps weren't great at the time, but you've learnt from?
Yeah, I'm not sure that there are best and worst career decisions. I mean, a career is just a collection of experiences. And so anything that gives you some breadth in that, people tend to assume that the moves that take you up the ladder are the best career moves. Actually, in my experience, it's the ones that give you the broadest suite of experience to draw on in the future. And so, on paper, my worst career decision was becoming the CFO of a small reinsurance company in my mid-30s. And it was the first time I'd been on the board, if you like, of a listed company. And it ended in cataclysmic failure. But what I learned in that 4 years has stood me in incredible stead for the rest of my career. And actually, even today, when I've been interviewed, even for this job, the experiences that people are most interested in are the ones where you've had your deepest, darkest troubles.
Mm.
Because people really want to understand how you tick when things are going out against you. It's easy to fly when everything's going in your favor. But how resilient you are and how you spring back from the difficult times is a much, much more important important talent.
Yeah, so I think. And what was your dream job as a child?
Well, I never had any imagination as a child, so I was kind of good at math. I did everything maths at school, and I went to did maths at university, and I never really had that sort of degree of inspiration. It's only as I've gone through life that I've realised what I really love is people and leading people through change, which is something I would never have thought of at that stage. But there may have been a clue, because my favourite toy was a cash register. So perhaps there was a giveaway.
Yeah. Perhaps there was. We'll come back to the people, the piece around leading people through change, because there's something I think is very personal at the moment that we'll talk about in a minute. But before we do, there are so few females or women at your level in business. What do you think are the biggest challenges that remain for women, and particularly the generation of women behind you? I mean, I know you've got an older teenage daughter. I think she's sort of nearly 20. What advice do you give her?
Yeah, I mean, it's an incredibly complex puzzle why things are still so skewed. And there are, I was trying to put it down to three things. If I can. One is that those of us who are in leadership positions, and actually those of us in societal positions, need to keep alive to what the conditions are we're creating in the environment around us. And that can be at a very early stage. I can remember Abby being at school, and she was, I don't know, 7 or 8. And the cricket pitches were in front of the school, and the netball courts were behind the school, and there were more cups for the boys than there were for the girls. And the girls' changing rooms were smaller, and the boys' changing school rooms had been redecorated, and every picture of a successful person was a male. And we're setting conditions right at that stage that set a path for people's expectations in life. So the first thing I'd say is we have to constantly challenge the expectation, not the choices that people make. I don't care if somebody wants to be a full-time professional, be a working mum, be a full-time mum, not have kids. All of those are choices. But I do resent the expectations that come with society. And that, I think, we all have a role in unbolting. I think people like me have to set the right conditions in companies to make sure that some of the biases that happen, whether intentionally or more often by accident, we're trying to iron out. That may be in the recruitment processes, and it may be in how we think about what kind of balance of people we want across the organisation. But some of it's in the hardwiring of processes, and some of it's in the culture that you set within an organisation. But there are also things that women have to do for themselves. And I see this. Seen this in myself, seen it in my daughter, I see it in almost every female colleague I've worked with. And it's just this self-belief and a bit of desire. So if you want to get into a really senior job, if you want to be on a FTSE 100 board, the prospect that someone is going to come and tell you you're the person that they want to do it is utterly naive. You have to want it, to go for it, to fight for it, and risk the embarrassment of not getting it. And that's something that is kind of quite alien to a lot of women.
Yeah.
So I really think there is a bit of re-gearing about self-belief and the willingness to take risks these are all generalisms, but in lots of women that would help empower them. The rest of it, the leaders of the organisations have to try and create in the system.
Yeah, I think you're right in terms of the self-belief and the desire and the ambition. And I think it relates to your earlier point about the conditions in which we find ourselves from young girls. You know, the changing rooms are smaller and not decorated. There are less cups for the girls than there were for the boys. And all of that sets out the path, doesn't it? Sets the wrong expectation, which in turn doesn't always do the best job of building that self-belief or that ambition to see it and be it.
So we can change that for our daughters.
Yeah.
So actually, it's within our own capabilities and within the capabilities of the next generation of female leaders coming through to change that in themselves. You know, it's a learned behaviour. So that would be my advice.
Thank you. You were obviously been CFO in before you were CEO. How did you make that change, I suppose, in mindset to move your focus in terms of the whole organisation, perhaps rather than just the financial performance? And how did you go about building the right team around you in those areas where you felt you needed to learn more?
Two interesting questions. Let me start by, you see, in a way, I see that transition as less dramatic than you might think, because to be a great CFO is not to be someone who is kind of in the depths of the numbers and the financials necessarily, which may sound bizarre, but a finance at its best is kind of what I always call the nervous system of the organization. So if the exco and the CEO and the board are sort of the brain, finance is all about making sure we're sending messages out to the different parts of the organization and receiving them back into the middle of the organization, so that we actually walk in the direction that we meant to. And when we get there, we know whether we've got there or not. And so to do that, you have to have a huge understanding of the cross, you know, the dynamics across an organization. Otherwise, you're just adding up. And so it feels like, it's also an incredible influencing and leading role because of that. Because what you may have people across the organization having instincts to pull in different directions. But if you're a good CFO, you're saying, I hear all that, but really we need to lead in this direction. And so for me, it didn't feel like such a huge transition in that sense to look organizationally wide. But you do have to be much more inspirational. It is a heavier balance of people. And actually, it's also, in a strange sort of way, less disciplined. So you have much more freedom of space to think. By the time I'd finished being a CFO, I'd kind of run out of room, and I felt the need to be much more expansive. And being CEO lets you do that. Lets you think much more freely. That's been fabulous. I think just time with more and more time with people across the organization has been fabulous as well. What were the gaps? I mean, my biggest gap was in marketing. In terms of the what, my biggest gap was in marketing. So fortunately, as you know, Claire, I have a fantastic marketing team. So my mentorship came from within, if you like.
Yeah.
And I asked them to teach me. But actually, generally, what do I do in terms of mentoring? I'm a great believer in you can learn from all sorts of different people. So I don't have one mentor or one coach particularly that I always link to, but I try and draw from different expertise and different skills across different places. And as a CEO, a lot of that is about how you set tone and how you set rhythm and how you get people to respond to you. So I've been looking for the best people leaders I can see, some of which are people who are much more junior than me in our organisation who are just fantastic at it. So that's what I generally do, is I just keep my eyes open. I keep talking to as many people as I can and then drawing off the best bits, honestly.
It's great to hear you talk about, you know, the freedom to think and the time now you get to spend, or more time you get to spend with the people, you know, lots of different people within the organisation. Just picking up on sort of the people point, I suppose. When we think about leadership, I'm sure you'll agree that, you know, the view of leadership or leadership styles has changed in recent times, and certainly, you know, years ago you might have thought of leaders as the old-fashioned command and control, or leading from the front, and now we talk far more about, you know, collaborative and expansive and often a more vulnerable style of leadership. How do you as a leader balance that sort of expectation that people sometimes expect, certainly the CEO, to have the answers, if you like, with perhaps showing vulnerability in order to build that openness and that trust within teams?
Wow, there's a lot to unpack in there, but it starts, why is vulnerability important? I think for a few reasons. One, that it makes you much more relatable. So if you're prepared to share something, I always think when you it's very conscious when I moved into this role, that at some point I'm going to ask people to do things that are deeply uncomfortable. Anyone can get to do things, people to do things that are kind of easy or in their natural vein or are happy or whatever. But at some point, if you're CEO, you have to ask people to do things that feel deeply uncomfortable. And to do that, people have to trust you. And they can only trust you if they know you. And so the first bit of being vulnerable as a leader is being prepared to let people know you. And kind of genuinely know you. Authentic is kind of, I guess, a widely used word for it. But because then they can build trust. And at the point that you really need them, and if you look at what we've just or are still going through on, with COVID, some of the things you're asking people to do are deeply outside their natural sort of risk parameters. And in a way, you're saying, just trust me. This one we've got to do. And so I try and shorten communication lines and build that over time, because I think it's incredibly important. It also means that people can talk to you about what their strengths and weaknesses are without feeling, with a greater degree of honesty. They don't have to show off all the time. You can get to the reality. And if I give you a great example of that, I go on a call with a number of CEOs who dial into Italy every Saturday lunchtime to hear a CEO of an Italian bank telling us what he's going through. And they're 4 weeks ahead of us. And so it's an insight into the world that's going to come your way. Mm. And the reason it's powerful is because he will tell us what he should have done, not just what he did. Because I can get to what he'd do. What's really interesting is what's the thing that he didn't think of that he could have thought of. If you can catch those, then you can be ahead of the curve. There's all sorts of reasons that being vulnerable is kind of is really powerful. I'm not sure that good leadership has necessarily changed in its definition. Perceptions of what a CEO looks like may have shifted, but when you think of some of the great leaders before you, I think they exist. Some of those traits, it's just people didn't necessarily think of them that way. If I ever need inspiration, I always kind of try and look through Nelson Mandela quotes, because not only obviously was an extraordinary human, but he was an extraordinarily articulate human, which I'm not. And he has one of his many brilliant quotes is, "I never lose, I either win or learn." And what an amazing, vulnerable statement that is from one of the greatest leaders who's ever existed. So I'm not sure that it's necessarily something that's changed, but certainly people's perception and expectations are progressively moving.
Yeah, I mean, that is an incredibly, incredibly powerful quote from Nelson Mandela. If we move on just to talk a little bit more about this year's theme for GATHA and going further together, we took our inspiration for that theme from a project that Google had conducted called Project Aristotle, which was conducted with many of their teams, 180 of their teams within Google, and done in collaboration with MIT and some psychologists and Carnegie Mellon. And it looked at those 180 teams and evaluated them over a whole series of variables. And it revealed sort of five ingredients that drive high performing teams. The first was very much what we've just talked about in terms of psychological safety and creating an environment where people feel safe to, you know, take risks and be honest and vulnerable in front of each other. The second one was around dependability, where you can be trusting team members to get things done on time and meet a high standard or set a high standard for themselves. The third was around structure. Fourth was around meaning, where work was personally important to team members and how that mattered within the team. And the fifth was around impact. We've talked quite a lot about, you know, safety and vulnerability and creating that trusting environment. So maybe we could move on to dependability. And we all know the pleasure of working with people around you who you know you can rely on to absolutely get the job done and job done to a high standard. But what happens when things sometimes slip? How do you engender that shared sense of dependability? And how do you encourage teams to really set the bar high for themselves?
Yeah, that really is a great question. And I'm not sure that when I listen to your list of five or so attributes of the team or the projects, the Google projects, list of those, in a way, I'm not sure they're separable. So you have to gather all of those attributes and kind of keep the ball moving and in the air and all of them in balance, I think. And that in itself is a challenge. I actually think best way to create sort of dependability is giving people visibility of what great looks like. And the best way of doing that is to surround them by people who are great and get stuff done. And so I think there's a real quality thing around that. But equally, part of getting them to dependable, I think, is linked to the points around structure and clarity. So helping people understand the path that they're all on together, knowing they're on it together and knowing they're being surrounded by talented people is all part of that trust build. And building the psychological safety so that they can share that together, so that they know where one another are coming from, means that, again, they build the trust in there. And I always look for the roadmap. If I'm not a detailed planner, I fall out of love with detail quite rapidly. But if I can see the path that we're trying to strive towards, I can feel the stretch in it, and other people can feel the stretch in it. I'm not going to kill someone if they fall short by 5%, but if we can all see one another striving to get there, and then we can celebrate landing steps on the way, all of that, I think, starts to build towards that dependability thing. I think the other thing is, and then brutally in the end, if someone doesn't fall into that criteria, if someone they feel isn't pulling their weight or letting the side down, then you have to address it. You can't live with it. And that's the tougher end of things.
Yeah, no, I'd agree. I suppose the piece, it's interesting you said, you know, that they're all interrelated, and I would agree with that, that there's almost five behaviours, but they are very much, they coexist in and around each other. That piece that you touched on in terms of everybody striving to get there, what do you think about you know, people finding meaning and impact in their work, that they can be striving to achieve a certain goal or project, but I think what the survey found, or what the study found, is finding meaning in your work means lots of different things to lots of different people, and it might not always be readily apparent. Do you think that with that approach, or with that approach of everybody striving in one direction, that any job can be meaningful?
No, because I think what makes an individual tick differs from person to person. And I think there's lots of studies that would suggest, you know, for people to be happy and really effective at work, they need to believe what they're doing is significant. They need kind of a sense of community, and they need a sense of excitement, you know, some energy, some enthusiasm. And so what you're doing can be important, but if it doesn't float your boat, it's going to be hard to get the excitement running. And so you kind of need to find, and it's very, I've always found it, certainly at relatively senior levels, there's rarely bad people or people who are bad at their jobs. It's quite often people in the wrong roles. And it's because it's not hitting one of those buttons, I think. So, and one of the reasons I joined DLG is because it's got a wonderful set of values around customer and around people. And it's kind of okay to really care about people. And actually, I've got this belief that you can use that to actually underpin and create commercial success rather than it being a trade-off against it. And so for me, that is the great interesting, you know, that's the great experiment, if you like. That's the great belief set. And so if you can create an environment where you're surrounded by people who really believe that, and I think a lot of DLG believed that before I walked in. So kind of the raw materials were there, if you like, from my perspective. Then you tend to draw people who are getting the sense of community and the sense of excitement from one another that they need, because that's the way they operate. That's their. And then if you can link that to what you're doing for your customers, whether you're selling retail products, you know, flying people around the world, whatever you may be doing, and in our case, you know, looking after people in the worst circumstances, trying to help people, you know, protect themselves from the worst things that can happen in life. If you can buy that and link that into that sense of community and impact, then I think you can create something really worth going for. And that works for a lot of people, but commercial, a lot of people are also competitive. So it's getting the right balance behind around the table of that as well, because you need some commercial competitive drive as well to outplay people in competitive marketplaces. And so when you construct a team, or when I construct a team, I'm trying to work out all the time if I've got the balance right between those characteristics. But we can keep the warmth and the empathy, but we've also got, you know, some real competitive fight and challenge in there. If you can create the environment, the psychological safety net, then actually as a team you can explore all those components, and it's kind of okay. It's okay that someone's raw competitive, and it's okay that someone else, you know, really just cares about people and that's what's bringing them to work, as long as you all understand where you're coming from.
I think that's great. That's great advice and insight, Penny, in terms of how you construct a team and thinking about that balance of competitiveness and drive versus the more people-focused, caring, empathy-centered I suppose, behaviours within the team. We're almost out of time, but there's one final question. Thank you very much for coming and being with us and talking to us today. It's been great. I want to give you the chance really to turn the tables and say, if you could pick any living woman to interview, who would you pick and why?
I think that's quite easy. I'd pick the Queen. Not because I'm particularly a royalist or not, but I hugely value experiences. I think in this sort of digital age and of change, there is still something incredibly valuable in someone who has seen stuff and seen people and seen their reactions and seen what it can create and what it can destroy. So to spend an hour with someone, who first worked with Churchill, was their first prime minister, and has seen the path since then through years and years and years, and accessed some of the biggest leaders, and spoken to people in all different walks of life, all different geographies. I would just be fascinated to know, when not under the burn of the cameras, what she really thought.
I think she'd have a lot of very interesting stories to tell. That's it, Penny. Thank you so much for coming, talking to us. It's been brilliant.
Thank you for the opportunity, and good luck with Gareth.
Thank you.